By Assad forces. 1,300 people are believed to have been killed on the outskirts of Damascus. The regime denies the accusations. The Foreign Secretary says time is of the essence in getting UN weapon inspectors to the scene.
I know that some people in the world would like to say this is some kind of conspiracy brought about by the opposition in Syria. I think the chances of that are vanishingly small. And so we do believe that this is a chemical attack by the Assad regime on a large scale.
Meanwhile, the United Nations says there are now 1 million child refugees as a result of the Syrian civil war. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees has described it as a tragic milestone. Dave Lee Travis has been released on bail after appearing in court on sex charges. The broadcaster is accused of 11 indecent assaults and one allegation of sexual assault on 9 victims dating back to 1977. He's expected to plead not guilty. The 68-year-old spoke briefly as he left Westminster magistrates.
I'll say one thing here, all right? One thing. Don't push. Please don't push.
I am supported by my wife and my friends, and my wife is not here today, and the reason she's not here today is because I detest hair crossing, okay?
That's the latest. I'm Anna Collinson.
UCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. And helping us review this week's news is Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim and Conservative Deputy Mayor Jeff Gollop. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, it's weapons of mass destruction again. It certainly looks like a nerve gas attack, but would Assad nerve gas his own people while the UN weapons inspectors are touring Syria? And former soldiers all over the Western world have been getting together for years now to campaign against what they believe are illegal wars, and the NATO government send them out to fight. We speak to one former British soldier who's just returned from a speaking tour of the US, talking to soldiers and veterans right across America. And on the home front, as the homeless shelter beds are closing, life is getting ever more impossible for Bristol's estimated 15 to 20,000 homeless people. So campaigners across the city are sleeping out tomorrow night to draw attention to their plight. Plus, Martin Summers' tour of the world's hotspots. And in case you thought our condemned government supported a free press, broadcasts around the world now banned here in Britain. This week, what our own former intelligence officers are saying on Iran's English language service Press TV. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 13 Celsius and some showers. This bank holiday weekend, temperatures high up as far as 23 degrees Celsius, wetter on Saturday, but sunnier on Sunday. Next week, bank holiday Monday, will be sunny, highs of 23 Celsius and a fairly sunny week. Next weekend, that's the 31st of August and the 1st of September, highs of 20 degrees Celsius, more sun. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim, Conservative Deputy Mayor Jeff Gollop. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony. Thank you.
First of all, the Tory party's whip in Bristol likes to stay in the shadows, John Galandris. He seems a bit microphone shy. I've asked him several times onto the show. Actually, as chief whip, he's in quite an important position, isn't he?
He is, yeah. John's a good friend of mine, and he's an excellent chief whip.
He's a bit busy. Also, he's a banker. This is one of the reasons I find this fascinating. Works for Coutts, who are the royal bankers, as I understand. Don't you think he would be able to shed light on a lot of the economics that we're going through on this show and other shows? A lot of people trying to get to grips with, get cut through the jargon to find out what's really going on. John surely is the man for the job.
I don't think it's quite as simple as that. If we're not careful, Martin and I could spend the next hour discussing this, but I think one of the problems is the people who actually work for the main high street banks have no more knowledge of what goes on at the higher levels that have created our banking crisis than you and I do.
Now, that's a bit nerve-wracking, because it means that the people who are working for the banks don't necessarily understand the economics either. But anyway, we'll see if we can get John on in future weeks, and I understand you're going to have a word with him, see if he'll come along.
Most certainly. Well,
okay. Now, you have also recently come back from a trip to Cuba. How on earth did you manage to land that one? That sounds fascinating.
Well, I was holiday, but it wasn't a holiday as you might know it. We were actually travelling in Cuba, seeing and experiencing what life's like in one of the few remaining communist control countries.
So was it in a personal role or an official role?
Totally personal role. Oh yeah, goodness me.
So you decided that you think you just wanted to get a taste of what Cuba was like.
I believe the best way of developing an understanding of political and economic issues around the world is actually to visit places that I don't necessarily agree with the way they're run, and see what I can see and what I can find out. And it was one of those wonderful experiences.
So was it a sort of know your enemy trip? Because I mean, you know, as a conservative, communism, surely that's your kind of the political opposite.
Well, I suppose you could have put it like that many years ago. Nowadays, you know, it's a different way of dealing with running that particular country. There are things that I could see that I felt were not the right way to do things, but there are some things they were getting right and we weren't. So,
okay.
So you know, it's simply part of understanding more how other people make their decisions, how these countries work, and hopefully something I can then use when I'm looking at how we deal with some of the problems Bristol's got to face.
Okay, so let's drill down to some of the real things that you saw there, particularly, and some specifics about what the Cubans have got right and what they've got wrong.
Well, a number of things that they haven't got right is that simply by controlling the economy, they were determining what courses people would study at university. For example, a lot of people graduates, but when they graduate, they don't choose to follow the course that they qualified in. They prefer to go into something relating to tourism, and the reason they want to do that is because they get tipped in foreign currency if they're working in tourism, which is worth significantly more than being paid in the local currency.
But hang on a minute. I mean, that's the same here, surely. When someone does a course at university, they don't necessarily go on in the same field. I mean, I studied, for example, physics at A-level, and then I went on to do other things in the arts, you know. So, I mean, you know,
absolutely,
and also, in Cuba, surely it's the same here, is that all the government is doing is they're setting the curriculum for the universities and what courses are on offer. Surely it's people's choice as to what they study.
But there was very much a two nations. It was those who had foreign currency and those who didn't, and that was a very strange concept. And not only that, it wasn't even you had to have foreign currency, they actually had an approved local currency that replaced the other local currency, so you had a sort of a second currency that those who were in the know were able to spend and benefit.
But in a funny way, it's the same here, Jeff, isn't it? I mean, we've got people with plenty of money, loads of money invested, for example, and then we've got others who are surviving on welfare. In a way, that's two kinds of currencies.
Yes, but welfare was an interesting concept. Or food was rationed rationed by price and availability. There was benefit in that they were provided with food, basic food, at relatively cheap prices as a starter. But the problem then was, how did they get more food? And there was begging on the streets. There were people in very desperate plight. So the system wasn't working. It wasn't providing universal support in the way that I had perhaps imagined it would be doing.
Okay, so you've picked out some of the things that weren't working over there. What about things that you did like? What did you see there that you think that we could learn from?
Well, interesting scenarios. Out in the countryside, decision made many years ago to reforest an area that had been deforested. Decisions to actually make sure that their tourism, their developments are sustainable and ecological. You don't have to go through the process of winning minds and convincing people, someone makes the decision. Now, I'm not, don't turn that round to make it suggest that I'm supporting autocratic dictatorial decisions, but one can actually see how the ability to make things happen is much, much greater when you don't actually have to consult with anybody. And I have a concern here that we have gone to the stage where we put so much effort into consulting that often we can lose the ability to make any decision at all.
Okay, so is that why you're in with the mayor here in Bristol? Because, I mean, that's partly, you know, a decision that Bristol's made, isn't it?
Well, you see, it's interesting. One of the things I think is exciting about the role of the mayor is if we look back over the years, Bristol was very much looking at a problem, after years of debate would conclude it was too difficult and would probably do nothing. George is actually prepared to get off the fence and make a decision. Now, I see that that's what Bristol needs, and all members of the cabinet accept that they may not always agree with every decision that the mayor makes, but I will defend absolutely his right to make those decisions and get Bristol moving, because this is a fantastic city, and he's already starting to make noises that mean that Bristol is being recognised nationally and internationally, which is good for trade, good for business, good for the local economy.
What about the economy in Cuba? I mean, what's the general standard of living like over there? I mean, you talked about begging, but I mean, obviously there is begging going on in Bristol, but probably I'm guessing not so much as Cuba.
No, Cuba, there was a lot of, first of all, very old property that had really not had vast amounts done to it in the last 50 years.
Well, I'm thinking about the carriage works now on Stokes Croft.
Yes, but that's the one-off example that you can rise if you were in Havana. I mean, my goodness, there's 1,000 carriage works in a square mile of the city. So it's a very, very different situation. I mean, you'd cross the road in front of some buildings because you weren't sure the balconies were actually had anything holding them up behind them. So there's an element of concern there, but also the high-rise buildings that were built to accommodate local residents, I have to say the view, I didn't go in them, but the view from the outside suggested there was very little living space, very cramped, very poor accommodation. But they are used to it, they accept it. They all have satellite television so that their leadership can tell them what the current issues of the day are, and they are conditioned to believe that they are lucky to have what they've got. A lot of spin, perhaps something in common with that.
Well, we certainly we've got plenty of that here in Britain.
Absolutely.
But I mean, just staying with the property angle, because I mean, I've seen over the last 20, 30 years a neglect of property here in Britain too.
Yep.
We've got quite a lot of buildings, some of them are actually owned by the city council.
Mm-hmm.
Many owned by property developers or big investment companies, office buildings particularly, which are now empty. We had Tony Crofts on here a few weeks ago, who's an ordinary person. He's a citizen of Bristol who's desperately trying to make sure that these office buildings don't stay empty for years, and that mm-hmm. if possible they're converted for cheap accommodation for the people, because as we could be hearing in the second hour, we've got something between 15,000 to 20,000 people classed as homeless here in Bristol. That is people who are sofa surfing, living in overcrowded accommodation, and we're desperate for find somewhere for them to live.
Yep. I see the housing problem as one of the biggest problems facing Bristol, and whilst a lot of the debate is about transport, for example, that's being pushed up the agenda as a matter of necessity, but actually some of the housing issues are not necessarily being shouted about as loudly. I see that that's got to change, not least because if Bristol's going to grow and get the benefits of the economic growth that's potentially there, it's got to have the ability to accommodate the workforce that it needs to take the city forward.
So, I mean, as an insider in the cabinet with Mayor Ferguson and the rest, what is the city's strategy for sorting out this problem of 15,000 to 20,000 homeless in the city?
The city has a real challenge because the main volume house building for the region is currently destined to take place in the neighbouring local authorities rather than within Bristol, and that is something that we have got to address. I have, but personally have very serious concerns about the number of stalled planning applications. And you mentioned the carriage works, and there are others, derelict sites around the city that actually ought, if the owners are not going to develop, in my view, then the council has got to look very seriously at whether it takes action to bring those sites into use for housing development, because that has to be one way of ensuring that we're getting affordable housing coming into the city. Otherwise, we are actually going to stifle our own growth.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, what's your take on this thing that Jeff was talking there about planning in Cuba? It sounds as if people in the government there, it's a communist country, just do things. There's no mass consultation. There's no real free market. Stuff just gets done. How does that compare to what's going on here? What are your thoughts on what Jeff was saying about Cuba?
Well, Cuba's a unique place. It's a communist country, but it's also a unique communist country. It's not the same as North Korea. It's not the same as China. I mean, China's a communist country, but it's an economic powerhouse. Mm-hmm. Cuba isn't. And you've got to remember, it's a small island, and they've still got an embargo on them from the United States, which is, you know, people aren't supposed to go there from the United States. They're banned and so forth. So you can't really generalise about communism in general from what goes on in Cuba. Personally, I'm not a big supporter of Cuba because you can't generalise what's happened there. For example, they don't have elections. I'm much more interested in the democratic left-wing governments in Latin America who win elections. Mm-hmm. But of course, they've got a lot more social problems in those countries as well. In Cuba, the Cuba will have to become more more open as time goes on. When some Cuban young people came here a few years ago, and they were from, you know, they were supporters of the regime, and I was saying, well, you're going to have to win a democratic election in Cuba sooner or later. Your generation is going to have to win it. So there's no reason why you can't win it, but you'll have to go out there and convince people.
Yeah. But Martin, you just said Cuba's a small country. It's got a population of over 11 million. I mean, that's something like a fifth of British population. It's actually an enormous island. I'm just going to look up to see how long it is from end to end.
It's one of the biggest islands. It's a bit bigger than Grenada.
150,
yeah.
200 at least miles long. But
longer than that.
Is it?
It's 600 plus miles long from end to end.
Okay, so how long did you spend there?
There for 2 weeks.
Okay, and did you spend quite a lot of time in the countryside, cities?
Yeah, we're in Havana for 3 days, and the rest of the time was travelling around the countryside.
And did you see any evidence of what Martin was saying, the sort of ban on travel from the US and that kind of thing? Would you see Americans, plenty of Americans, tourists not, there, I suppose?
Not, not a lot. There were Americans, but not a lot of Americans. But I mean, if I just tell you, just in terms of transport, I mean, the intriguing thing is you've got 2- and 3-lane motorways, with the inside lane being used for the locals with their horse and carts. I mean, that's the bit that sets the example of the economic climate and the way the country's
developed. Well, there's also an environmental aspect to that, isn't there, absolutely. Because, you know, they're not using up these fossil fuels, and also there probably, you know, is a place in Britain still for the use of
there almost certainly is.
Farm equipment, which isn't just...
The other end of it is the 1950s gas guzzlers that were probably more than compensating, of which there are thousands out there.
Okay, well, thanks very much. That's fascinating stuff about Cuba. On to the news now. And 7 million is due in compensation as banks are landed with a 1.3 billion compensation bill for missold credit card insurance. Well, we've had the interest rates swaps mis-selling, otherwise known as fraud. We've also had the PPI mis-selling, otherwise known as fraud. Now another one with this CPP company. This is something we're going to be hearing from again. It looks, Jeff, as if the bank have got together and set up as a sort of an arrangement with this company CPP to fraudulently sell the public insurance that they don't need and probably didn't want.
I think that sums it up pretty well. I mean, I can only speak for me. I looked at things like this when I took out a credit card, had a look at it and thought, this is a con. And I refused. What I don't think I realised is quite the extent that people were signing up, almost presuming it was part of the necessity of having the credit card. Personally, I think there's an even bigger issue here, which is about the mass selling of credit cards and the interest rates that credit card companies charge on their balances, because I fear that a large number of consumers do not understand what is going on. I think there was a survey a couple of weeks ago, there was a survey that reckoned that 25% of people didn't actually understand their bank statements.
Well, 7 million customers are affected by this. Yeah. We're talking about various companies, that Barclays, Santander, Royal Bank of Scotland, HSBC, Tesco Personal Finance and MBNA are among the 13 banks and financial institutions that now face a payout. Martin, what's going on here? Again, banks and one of these companies that's working with the banks, this CPP firm, simply conning people on the phone often, sometimes letters in the post, sign on the dotted line, you need protection, where they've already got protection. This is fraud.
Well, yes, payment protection insurance. I did some work on this a few years ago. I mean, it's missold because, of course, you can only claim it if you are made redundant from a job. If you're self-employed or anything of that sort, that you can't claim it anyway. I did, in fact, manage to make a successful payment protection claim a few years ago because I was made redundant and I was able to demonstrate that I had been made redundant, and therefore they paid the payment protection kicked in and actually helped me out. But lots of people, the small print is that it doesn't cover people who are self-employed, for example, but they get sold it anyway, and I'm certainly paying payment protection insurance on my current credit card.
Well, CPP was fined £10.5 million by the FCA last year for its role in mis-selling and has battled to stay in business ever since. Details of a new bank facility published on the 31st of July reveal it will have to renegotiate the loan if more than 25% of customers due compensation seek redress. The Financial Conduct Authority, the regulator, said that in most cases the credit card and ID theft cover sold by CPP and the banks was not required, as it was already provided on the cards, or the risks and consequences of not taking the insurance were overstated. This almost sounds to me like gangsterism, Jeff. I mean, the CPP are selling people insurance that they don't need, they've already got, and they don't want. It's just a simple con.
Well, it is. And I think what it shows is one of the big problems is that in spite of all that's gone on, people look at a bank that recommends they buy something and they believe it. And I think this has got to raise questions about the way that financial products are marketed. But I come back to one of the reasons why you wouldn't need this insurance most of all was a very, very old-fashioned approach that says you only put on credit card what you can afford to pay for. And if you could afford to pay for it when you put it on the credit card, you wouldn't need the insurance. And we have got to the stage where there is so much personal finance on credit cards that people are then intimidated or frightened into taking out insurance as a protection. And we have made credit far too easily available for far too many people. And that has been part of the financial problem the country's got itself into. And to be honest, we need to look at how readily that credit card is made available. And I said it just now, the interest rate, people are paying 30 or 40% interest rate on credit cards. And they wouldn't sign up to a bank loan for that. They'd know it didn't make sense. But because they've signed up to a credit card, they think it does. So actually, it's a wider problem than just this insurance. It's the whole concept of people borrowing on credit cards and paying it off long term, which financially makes no sense whatsoever. Absolute madness.
Martin, money made out of this apparently is in around about 1.3 billion by this company CPP, and yet they've only been fined 10 million.
Yes, which of course is basically...
So far.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of the fines that, I mean, the LIBOR scandal and all the rest of it, the fines are trifling. And of course, what that means is people who are involved in skullduggery in financial markets know very well that that's basically a green light to carry on doing what you're doing.
But CPP, what they're doing, or what they have done up till now, is they've been playing in a quite a vicious way, really, on people's fears of not having enough money. Now, they know for a fact, we know for a fact, that there are millions millions of people out there who are concerned about not having enough money to meet the bills. So what they've done is they've actually capitalised on that. Mm. They've seen it as a way of marketing a useless product at people who are afraid that they won't be able to pay their electricity bills.
The real problem is that we've got to wage repression going on in Britain at the moment. Real wages have fallen over the last few years. In the United States, real wages haven't risen since 1973. And that means, of course, that people aspire to having a consumer lifestyle, but without wage increases, people basically then borrow money in order to have the lifestyle that they want. And that's one of the, you know, subprime mortgages, for example, in the US were part of that whole process.
Which we're now doing here with the Help to Buy. Jeff, I'll give you the final word on this. What do you think should happen to the people that have done this, and how have they managed to get away with it? Again, another fraud, mis-selling scandal.
Well, I think this is going to be a real challenge for the Financial Conduct Authority, because they actually have to exert some very clear punishment on those responsible to show that they are committed to making sure this doesn't happen again. And they alone can punish what has gone on. And this is people who I suspect started off only thinking they were doing their job, and then discovering that actually they'd found something they could sell and they exploited it. What one perhaps should also be questioning is, why has it taken so long for it to be identified?
Okay. Also, bad news for George Osborne this week. Surprises as the deficit rises despite UK's growth momentum. This is Ben Chew in The Independent. The city was caught off guard as a surprise July deficit kept the Treasury waiting for a significant boost to public finances from a flowering economic recovery. Underlying public borrowing stood at £500 million over the month, compared with the £800 million surplus posted in July 2012. According to official figures, the city consensus had been for a £2.5 billion surplus. Driven by the rapidly improving economic outlook. So we normally, apparently in July, there's a surplus. This is basically, the deficit is measured by the amount of money that's coming in and the amount of money that's going out of the government, the spending versus the receipts, mostly from tax. Even though the main mission of the government economically is to get this deficit down, looks like it's going up, and certainly it was up in July. But that's not the whole story, because on top of this, there's also the interest payments on the £1 trillion of debt that the government holds. So even if there was a surplus, we're not actually eating into the actual debt. Anyway, before we hear from our guests in the studio, let's have a listen to Treasury Minister David Gawke explaining the deficit rising in July.
I think, first of all, we have to look at how these numbers are reached. Tax receipts are up. That's encouraging, a good sign that corporation tax from areas other than North Sea oil has increased significantly. Income tax receipts are up. As far as spending is concerned, essentially what has happened is that items of spending that were booked in other months in previous years have been booked in July for this year. Within education, health, international development, defence, European Union contributions have this year been placed in July, whereas in other years they've been placed in other months. And as a consequence, the profile is somewhat different. So, to be honest, there's nothing in the numbers that we're particularly concerned about.
That was David Gawke, Treasury Minister. Martin, what do you make of that? He's saying actually it's just a little bit of an accounting trick in a way, in that accidentally stuff has moved from other months, the spending, into July, which is why the deficit is now £500 million, and they haven't managed to get rid of it, which is their main objective.
Yeah, well, I think what's happened, because the slippage on deficit reduction, I think that's got a lot to do with whatever signs of growth we're seeing in the economy. Because in the real world, it's quite difficult to get the deficit down, even if you want to get it down. But in actual fact, that leads to a situation where the economy, in fact, has not been hammered as heavily as it might have been had you managed to get it down. So the government kind of ends up doing the right thing, as it were, by accident, because the deficit slips. And of course, it's not a major problem if the deficit slips. The real problem, of course, is the underlying debt, as you mentioned. And of course, the other problem is that there's possibly going to be another financial crash. George Soros this week, I noticed that you picked this up, he's taken a bet, a £1.5 billion dollar bet that the stock market will collapse. Most people haven't paid attention.
Well, you shouldn't say that, because there'll probably be other people out there thinking, George Soros is in the know.
He's such a big mover. When he says that's going to happen, other people take notice.
I mean, I'm being slightly flippant, but isn't that the case? That it's one of the reasons that bits of news like that don't get out to a mass population is because it could have actually an effect on what George Soros does could just simply be picked up by other people.
That's what he did when he bust the pound out of the exchange rate mechanism. He took such a big bet against the pound that everybody else had to follow him. And he's such a market maker that when he says things are going to happen, then they do. And of course, that gives him an awful lot of power.
Okay, Jeff, the main problem here being that the Conservative Lib Dem coalition government's main objective and George Osborne's main objective is to reduce the deficit, $500 million deficit in July.
Yeah, I mean, but Martin's absolutely right. The problem is the economy is not recovering fast enough to generate sums of money capable of paying down the debt. And therefore, timings can be key on when money is spent. But the other thing is, the government's got itself conflicting messages, because on the one hand, it's trying to cut public spending in order to reduce the spend, but on the other hand, it's desperately encouraging shovel-ready capital projects to actually keep the economy moving and accelerate. And so you've got two conflicting items there, and there is a very delicate balance, because if the government doesn't spend and encourage capital spend to keep the economy buoyant, then actually the tax take will fall and the deficit will get worse. So it's a very delicate one, and I think the comment that on 1 month is not enough to be worried about, I think that if we saw another couple of months of that going in the same direction, then yes, there would be serious concerns. At this stage, it could well just be timing differences.
But the national debt topped £1 trillion pounds last year. It's creeping up the whole time. I mean, the deficit is not making a dent in it at all. Ben Chu, one thing I love about Ben is that he always puts these figures in. A lot of the articles don't.
But it's actually far worse than that.
He's talking about the national debt. If I can just finish this. The actual national debt now is at £1.19 trillion. So it's gone up £200 billion. Just since last year, Jeff. I mean, they're not making any real dent in it at all.
But it's actually far, far worse than that, because if you compared it with 20 years ago, you would not have all the PFI funding and all the different funding that's gone off the government's balance sheet. So actually the amount that is borrowed by the public sector is massively more than is being reflected as the public sector debt.
Good God, sounds frightening. Martin, also, what about this? Ben mentions that the national debt is now effectively 1.2 trillion, an equivalent to 75% of GDP. Now, why is that equivalence to GDP important when you're looking at the national debt?
Well, it's the debt to GDP ratio, which is what you're interested in. Of course, that can be improved by having GDP rising.
It's just going up by a couple of points of 1% at the moment.
We've had wall-to-wall quantitative easing and zero interest rates for 4 years, and we've managed just about to get some kind of growth in the economy. I don't think I'm being pessimistic when I say we're staring down a barrel of a gun here. The financial markets have not been reformed. There's a $144 trillion derivatives market out there, and if interest rates rise, as they seem to be doing, long-term interest rates seem to be creeping up, then the central banks will lose control of the situation, and then we're going to have a crash that makes 2008 look like a walk in the park.
What do you think, Jeff?
Well, I think one of...
Are you as pessimistic as Martin?
We've got to be prepared for the worst.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd never be as pessimistic as Martin, but we have got to be prepared. And the other thing that Martin touches on, that if you like the derivatives and the speculative trade is massively more than the actual real trade, say in foreign exchange, for example. It's about 2% of the total trade on foreign exchange is real people importing, exporting, and going on holiday. The other 98% is people betting on it. And we've got to the stage, therefore, where the whole international economy is more dependent on people who are speculating than it is on people generating real trade. And it does mean that people can call the tune in a way that means it's not entirely representative, and therefore it's not entirely down to what the government does, it's what outsiders are doing in terms of speculating in terms of the UK's future.
So keep an eye on George Soros. I think that's one of the lessons from this. Mm-hmm. Also this week, Princess Diana's death. Police are probing sensational claim that she was killed by the SAS. This is the Daily Express, and various other newspapers reported this story. The allegation has emerged at the second court-martial of Sergeant Danny Nightingale, who was found guilty of illegally possessing a gun and ammunition. Police are investigating this sensational claim that the SAS were involved in Diana's killing. The allegation emerged at the second court-martial, and it came as a letter to the elite unit's commanding officer by the parents-in-law of a special forces sniper known only as Soldier N, who was Sergeant Nightingale's former housemate and a key witness for the prosecution. The letter said Soldier N boasted that the SAS was behind Princess Diana's death. Ministry of Defence, the Royal Military Police and the Service Prosecuting Authority have known of its existence since the claim it was sent in September 2011. Well, I suppose, Jeff, maybe this is one of the lessons that the Crown Prosecution Service must learn when they're prosecuting people in the SAS, is that little things like this might come out that they'd rather hadn't.
I'm not sure that you'd say they'd rather hadn't. I mean, it's a question. It's a question of whether something like this is a distraction being used to get away from an individual having to face up to what they have done and what they've caused to happen. To be honest, the conspiracy theories that have been existing around the Princess Diana's death have been out there for years. There have been inquiry after inquiry. I have a feeling, out of respect, the time has come to actually stop having further inquiries.
But it means the inquest wasn't a conspiracy theory, and it found that it was unlawful killing, that not accidental death. That was the inquest, a full coroner's inquest carried out by the Royal Coroner. So, I mean, but yet nobody has actually been subsequently prosecuted, even though the killing was seen to be unlawful.
Mm. Yeah. But it just seems to me that one can go back in an event of many years ago and probe and ask questions, but is any good going to come of that?
Well, that's a good question.
And I've got a feeling that this sounds to me like spectacular journalism rather than something based in any substance.
And of course we will be going back over the assassination of John F. Kennedy this year, because it's the 50th anniversary. Mm-hmm. But Martin, what do you make of these allegations in this SAS trial? I mean, these guys quite clearly shouldn't have had ammunition, guns, grenades or whatever it was that they had. But do you think that there could be some potential truth in this letter that was sent to one of the commanders of the SAS?
Well, I understand that the chap making this allegation in the letter, it was used as evidence.
Soldier N is called.
Yeah, Soldier N. It was used as evidence that he'd lost the plot, because there was various other things that he'd supposedly lost the plot about. Now, leaving aside whatever conspiracy theories there may or may not be about, I mean, Mohammed Al-Fayed has been absolutely clear from the very beginning that he thinks she was murdered. I won't comment on that. But I mean, I think as Jeff said, this is journalists trying to make a story to sell newspapers.
But I mean, no, it's not. It's a document which was released in a court case, which is being reported.
But it's been misreported and misrepresented, because as I understand it, the document was actually used as evidence that Soldier N lost the plot in various ways, and one of these ways is that he was making.
But obviously, Soldier N is saying, I hadn't lost the plot actually.
Well, I think that these are legitimate concerns. People have legitimate concerns about these things. You mentioned John F. Kennedy. There's still massive questions asked about that, and Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King, incidentally, they had a civil trial in the United States, and the family convinced the jury that he was in fact assassinated by the FBI, and that the jury in the United States has already decided that was the case. And of course, I'm afraid assassination of political leaders is as American as apple pie.
Well, yes, as you said, Jeff, there have been many investigations into Diana's death. There was the British initial police inquiry, there was one in France too, and the inquest. But I think what's really not got through to the public at all is that she was unlawfully killed. that's what the inquest found, and it's sort of been left hanging in the air. I mean, there is a very good book I've read by John Morgan, who's a retired investigative journalist in Australia, called Princess Diana, the Paris-London Connection, which really does go into some, you know, pretty incredible details. For example, saying that he believes that that she was killed because she was about to announce her engagement to Dodi Al-Fayed, and this was seen as unacceptable by the royal family. But I think that the ultimate question here is why, although it's been proven that Diana was unlawfully killed, why there's been, you know, sort of no proper investigation into who did that afterwards. Anyway, another story, the petition is calling on the mayor in Bristol to close all strip clubs in the city. Bristol Mayor George Ferguson has been urged to close all strip and lap dancing clubs. Petitions launched calling on city councillors, that's you, Jeff, the petition proposes altering the policy to state that the appropriate number of such venues in Bristol is zero.
Well, I find myself in a difficult situation here in that, as far as I'm concerned, I would be entirely happy if all those strip clubs were closed down. But I believe that there has to be freedom of choice for those who want to perform and those who want to attend. And therefore, I find it very difficult to prescribe that that number should be set at nil, even though my personal view would support that decision.
So why are you so against strip clubs?
I don't believe that. I believe they're disrespectful. They they are not respecting adults and respecting each other in the way that I would expect to respect other people.
But I mean, surely the women that are employed in them are there of their own free choice, their own free will?
And that is ultimately why...
Isn't it up to them?
And that is why I take the view that it should be a freedom of choice of the individual, and why I would not be prepared to support a universal policy of closure, which is what's being recommended here, because there has to be freedom of choice for the individual.
Martin, a licensing amendment of this kind has been successfully proposed and achieved in Swansea.
Well, I mean, people are entitled to make a petition and they're entitled to try and campaign for their view. But if they can get sufficient support, then maybe they could make it stick. But it is very difficult to ban people from doing things which are not illegal. It's not illegal for people to go to strip clubs. It just isn't. And Urban Tigers mentioned it. I actually went in there by accident. I went in there by accident. I thought it was just a late drinking place, so I went in and I suddenly realized, oh blimey, it's one of these kind of places. I paid to come in, I'll see what it's like. And so I was there for about 5 minutes and I started dancing around a bit, but then this chap, burly chaps, came over to me and said, leave the dancing to the girls. And I thought, blimey, it's like cold, it's in here. So I just went off and went somewhere much more pleasant, where in fact you were allowed to dance and people weren't sort of leering over your shoulder and saying that leave all the dancing to the girls. It was a rather depressing place, I found.
I mean, if they've achieved this in Swansea, why not here? I mean, if the petition gets enough signatories, surely it's your duty to close these clubs.
I think we listen to the issues, but I'd be interested to know, they may have achieved it in Swansea. But the one thing that I think is really important is that when it's licensed, it's open. It is clear that it is happening, and in fact, you can regulate using the license process so that it is only licensed clubs that are in existence.
I wonder what's the situation in Cuba. I mean, did you see any of these kind of play? Because we were talking earlier on about the more sort of planned.
We were there on a family holiday, so
you didn't see any.
No, but I am. I was fairly reliably informed that you could find such clubs extremely easily.
Not necessarily licensed, and I suppose that's the point you're making there.
Exactly, and the moment therefore they go underground and are not licensed, you have got a far greater challenge for regulating those clubs. Whereas when they have to go down this process, you know where they are because they've applied for the license, you know who the owners are, and you're able to ensure that they maintain the standards that you have determined. So, you know, it's not as simple as just saying, yeah, we'll regulate down to nil. That isn't, you know, produces all sorts of other issues.
On to another big story this week. David Miranda, Schedule 7 and the danger that all reporters now face. Now, this was a pretty devastating article by the editor of The Guardian, in The Guardian, about the arrest of David Miranda at the weekend on his way into Britain. Apparently, it seems, with some secret information for journalistic use, something to do with this Edward Snowden case, that The Guardian were due to write a story or stories about. Obviously, we won't be reading those stories in The Guardian now, at least for the time being. But what's your thoughts initially on this, Jeff, about really what's the priorities here? Whether, you know, this guy really should have been arrested under terrorism legislation. Was David Miranda a terrorist or was he a journalist?
I think we may have to wait and see what comes out of the further investigations. But I have to say that I think freedom of the press is one of the most fundamental tenets, if you like, of our existence. And I would be very reluctant to see anti-terrorist legislation used against the press.
So you disagree with David Cameron? Is it seems he was the person. I mean, he was asked, "Do you think we should?" And he I mean, I don't know if he's on the holiday. I think he was. This is not just the cabinet secretary doing this. It was something which David Cameron has sanctioned. So maybe he's in the loop a little bit more than you.
Well, that's
as to how secret this stuff is.
I think it's possible he knows a little more about this than I do, and therefore I'm only saying my own personal view is the importance of the freedom of the press. But if there is a threat to national security, then there is a need for that to be protected. My own personal view on the Snowden issue is that I've always had the view that if I'm doing nothing wrong, I actually don't have a problem with people knowing that I'm doing nothing wrong.
So you don't have the problem with GCHQ reading all your emails and knowing your passwords and all that?
To be honest, I don't have a problem with people doing that because I don't believe there's anything I'm doing that is untoward.
Now, Martin, the Council of Europe have pronounced on this in the last couple of days, condemning the British government, David Cameron specifically, for this arrest. Why has the Labour Party been so utterly silent? We haven't heard almost anything at all from the Labour Party on this one. They've left it to the Council of Europe.
I think there's been fairly... I think opinion across the board has been fairly negative about this. This also came out that they've been GCHQ officers have been round to the Guardian's offices 2 months ago and destroyed a computer hard drive, and the Guardian were just saying, well, you can do that if you like, but don't forget we've got all of this copied in Brazil. And of course the Brazilians have brought this up in the UN, because of course all over the world people are fed up with the Americans spying on them.
Well, that was a bizarre incident, wasn't it? So the Guardian had a computer, GCHQ turned up at the Guardian with the cabinet secretary saying, we want that information.
They said, you've had your fun, we want our stuff back.
Yeah, so and Alan Rushbridge, the Guardian, has then refused to hand it over, and they came to some sort of gentleman's agreement that rather than hand it over, he would smash up the computer in a rather pointless exercise. Actually, some vandalism, really, since they...
Pointless vandalism, because they've got a computer with it all on in Brazil.
They've said that they copied the information on the computer anyway. The whole thing is so Kafkaesque. It has to be unbelievable, Jeff.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. I have to say I'm not normally one to be jumping to the defence of the Guardian.
they're breaking some very big stories internationally.
But, you know, I come back to I could link this into Cuba, where one looks at the situation where what is published is only what has been through an approval process. And actually, that weakens the community, that weakens society. So one needs that freedom, but I'm not prepared to make a full judgment on this until I see the outcome of what is being suggested the government consider the need to invoke the legislation in the first place.
Anyway, one person who's very, very much committed and supports David Cameron's decision and the Cabinet Secretary is the Conservative MP, Brooks Newmark.
Well, I certainly wouldn't be taking any lectures from Putin, who has no respect for human rights at all. The White House wasn't sort of saying they wouldn't do this. They just neatly sidestepped the question. First of all, Mr. Miranda himself, who admitted he didn't even know what he was carrying. So I think he's got to be a little careful about when he is carrying things, that he does understand what he is carrying. And the fact that his partner himself used his partner as a mule to carry information. You know, I really find it a little bit much to take any lectures from Mr. Greenwald when he himself said yesterday, I have more information on England's spy systems and they will, I think they will be sorry for what they did. He doesn't have Britain's interest at heart at all. As we all know, technology today is pretty powerful. So if you leave your mobile phone on your desk, unfortunately, any spy agency around, the Russians, the Chinese, probably the Americans, the British as well, can actually go into a phone that is switched off and pull off information. As I said, Mr. Greenwald himself has said yesterday that he has information on England's spy agencies that he will now use, he said, in a more vigorous fashion, which may harm Britain's interests. David Cameron sent in his top civil servant into The Guardian. Today's discussion is about the arrest of Mr. Miranda. That was a decision by the police, not by politicians.
But it was certainly run past Cameron. That's also come out. On the other side of the story, one of the great things about this story is it's brought out into the national news the investigative journalist Duncan Campbell, who I'm a massive fan of over the years. He's quite an inspiring journalist who's dug into much to do with the secret state that we're not supposed to know about. And one of those things, of course, was the ABC trial back in the 1980s, where Duncan Campbell first published to the public the existence of GCHQ, which was supposed to be entirely secret. So let's see what he had to say about this as well, because he was on the news as well. Actually, I'm just looking for that clip and it doesn't seem to be appearing for some strange reason. Maybe GCHQ have hacked into our computer here. But Martin, can you just tell us what you thought about what Tory MP Brooks Newmark was saying there?
Well, I put the question, is this lawful? Is this a lawful use of the anti-terrorist legislation? Anti-terrorist legislation was passed in 2000, so this is actually before 9/11. It is open to question whether it is lawful to arrest journalists under anti-terrorist legislation. And ultimately, let's have a day in court and find out whether it is lawful. Because if they are just going to use anti-terror legislation to intimidate journalists, then we're quite clear where we stand.
Well, I would have preferred that it hadn't happened, because I think it is a dangerous route to go down, but equally it has to be done in the context that you can only do this very, very rarely. So one has to say, one presumes, the internal information suggested there was significant risk to the state in going down that route, and I will wait to hear what the outcome is of that investigation.
Well, hopefully we can hear from Duncan Campbell now.
They're in a state of panic. They've overreached themselves, and examination of what they're trying to hide suggests that the terror, if there's any terror, is that we in Britain should be terrified that a whole secret network has been built to spy on everything we do without parliamentary knowledge or approval, and indeed under a smokescreen of dishonesty and deception. The claims of terrorism are as absurd as when I first exposed GCHQ 30 years ago. It was a complete secret, operating out with the law. And the consequence of that was very similar. Two journalists, Americans who helped me, were deported. And I was arrested and eventually faced espionage charges and 30 years imprisonment. It all fell apart under public ridicule. The same thing happened again in the 80s with books on intelligence and a program I made for the BBC. Claims of national security fell apart. The modern name, terrorism. But, yes, of course there's terrorists out there, and yes, they mean us harm. It does not follow that what GCHQ is trying to hide and getting the government and the strong-arm boys in to try and keep away from us has anything to do with protecting us from terrorists. Whether David Miranda was carrying material or not, whether or not he was carrying it, had nothing to do with terrorists. It had to do with GCHQ spying on people in Britain. It had to do with GCHQ's trying to build an empire of secret surveillance around the world. And that is what the Cabinet Secretary was desperately trying to hide. What GCHQ does is largely driven by a desperate need to stay under the American wing that they see. The Americans have declassified material, they've announced that they will reveal secret laws that they were made, they've accepted that some of this never ought to have been secret. Britain has just tried, in a traditional knee-jerk way, to try and hit the messenger. What GCHQ has to learn, and what ministers ought to take notice of the lessons of history, GCHQ and the British nation survived being brought out into the open. It took 17 years after my articles for GCHQ to actually be made legal and accountable. But they are now accountable, and they have spent a year on a deception of Parliament claiming that they needed new capabilities and £1 billion to be spent on them. Well, now we know they had them all along and were hiding them away. They are going to be held accountable for those deceptions, and that is what scares them. Not Islamic terrorists, they're terrified of us. Every policeman, every police station in the country has a duty and a role to protect us from terrorists. That's part of their job. Do we therefore say that every policeman must be secret, that we must never see their photographs, that we do not know where police stations are? Of course GCHQ has a valid role, finding out information about terrorism, giving that information to break their plots. What they have not learnt is how to live in a civil society with a sense of proportion, that they are accountable citizens to the extent they spy on us. They have to make their case for the scale of astounding spying that they are doing, out with the codes of human rights that we're set up to. And I don't think they have that case. The old secret institutions and the desperate need to hang on to budgets and secret missions and an alliance with the United States is driving a great deal of this.
What about, Jeff, what Duncan Campbell said there about the deception of Parliament? I think that's probably the nub of what he was saying. The most important is he's saying that they've asked for £1 billion from Parliament for a programme which actually they could do perfectly easily with the money they already had.
I don't know enough about that to be able to judge. I know that in local government terms, anybody putting in an application for a capital project will always look to get a little bit more in on the back of the project than they thought they needed, so when it's cut back they can still get what they want. So whether therefore you've got something that is really concealing what was put to Parliament, or whether you simply have part of a normal political process, I wouldn't like
Martin,
to say.
Martin Farley, what about this? I mean, what Duncan Campbell's accusing them there is using their powers to actually deceive Parliament, not only the public, but Parliament too.
Yes, it's on the foreign governments as well, are very fed up with having their communications tapped into. So, for example, the trade deal between the EU and the United States has gone down the toilet over this. The Germans aren't going to negotiate if they're going to have their private conversations listened to by the NSA.
Okay, so that's it now for our news review. There's some other stories I would love to have done, particularly to do with KPMG and a certain person who's being just managed not to become a crime boss. But anyway, thanks to this week's guest, Councillor for Westbury on Trim and Conservative Deputy Mayor Jeff Gollop. After the news, WMD all over again.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, President Obama says a possible chemical weapons attack in Syria this week is a big event of grave concern. The country's opposition claims hundreds...